Thomas Hobbes, a thunderstorm rages outside a small stone vicarage in Westport, England, on an April night in 1588. Inside, a woman cries out in premature labor, frightened out of her wits. Rumor has spread that the mighty Spanish Armada is poised to invade England. Every church bell from Cornwall to Kent is ringing alarm. The pregnant woman's heart pounds with dread for her country, and that fear now forces her child into the world early. So it is that Thomas Hobbes enters life, an infant born amid panic and turmoil. Years later, Hobbes will wryly remark that his mother gave birth to twins, myself and fear. From his very first breath, fear would indeed be Hobbes's lifelong companion and muse. Thomas Hobbes's childhood was as unsettled as the times. He was born in Malmesbury, where his father served as a rather ill-tempered vicar. When Hobbes was just a boy, his father got into a violent quarrel at the church door. Some accounts say fists flew, and soon after, the disgraced elder Hobbes fled town, never to return. Young Thomas and his siblings were taken in by their well-off uncle, a glovemaker who valued education. The shy, bright child quickly proved a gifted student. He learned Latin and Greek almost as soon as he could read English. Often he could be found perched in his uncle's library loft, devouring volumes of classical history. Perhaps in those stories of ancient wars and empires, the boy sought order and stability lacking in his own family life. At 15, Hobbes entered Oxford University, walking under the medieval spires of Magdalen Hall. Oxford's curriculum still clung to the old ways, lectures in Latin on Aristotle's logic and theology. Hobbes dutifully absorbed the lessons, but found little inspiration in scholastic hair-splitting. In dusty lecture halls, he listened to endless debates about how many angels could dance on a pinhead. He grew quietly skeptical. How did any of this help one understand the real world? Outside the university walls, England buzzed with new scientific ideas. William Harvey discovering the circulation of blood, Francis Bacon urging the experimental method. But inside, the dons clung to musty traditions. Hobbes later recalled his college years with thinly veiled scorn. He had wanted knowledge solid as geometry, but found only arguments as insubstantial as clouds. Fortunately, Hobbes's keen mind and classical learning did not go unnoticed. Upon graduating, the young man was recommended as a tutor to an aristocratic family, the Cavendishes, Earls of Devonshire. Thus began a new chapter of travel and high society. In 1610, Hobbes, barely cast 20, accompanied his pupil on a grand tour of the continent. Stepping onto a boat across the channel, he felt the thrill of leaving insular England behind. Europe was in a ferment of ideas. In France, Hobbes conversed in his fluent Latin with scholars about politics and poetry. But it was in Italy that he found the greatest inspiration, an audience with the famed astronomer Galileo Galilei. Imagine Hobbes in 1636 climbing the marble steps of a villa near Florence to meet Galileo, who by then was under house arrest by the Inquisition for his revolutionary claims. The aging Italian savant greets Hobbes cordially and leads him to a terrace. Through Galileo's homemade telescope, the two men gaze at a moon pitted with craters, at moons circling Jupiter, proofs that shook old beliefs about a perfect heavens. Galileo, animated despite his troubles, demonstrates a ball rolling down an inclined plane, showing how it accelerates uniformly. Hobbes watches, enthralled. Here, at last, was knowledge derived from observation and reason, not authority and superstition. Matter, motion, mechanics, Galileo saw a universe ruled by laws, not whims. Hobbes drank in these ideas like a man starved. As he took his leave, the Englishman's mind churned with a realization. The same rational principles that governed falling bodies and planets might also govern human society. Returning to England, Hobbes carried a notebook filled with insights from abroad. He translated a towering work of ancient history, Thucydides, account of the Peloponnesian War, perhaps sensing that civil strife was not just a tale of the ancients. Indeed, England itself was drifting toward a conflict. Tensions between King Charles I and Parliament mounted by the year. Hobbes, like many intellectuals, tried to stay above the fray at first. He preferred the quiet of his study at the Cavendish estate, pondering geometry or discussing philosophy with friends. Yet politics would soon upend his life. By 1640, the quarrel between king and parliament erupted into what would become the English Civil War. London seethed with unrest, royalists and reformers girded for battle. Hobbes was then in his early 50s, an established scholar but no man of action, fearful that his known royalist sympathies might put him in danger with the revolutionaries. Hobbes packed a trunk of manuscripts and fled to Paris. In the French capital gathered a community of English exiles, loyalists who had followed the Queen into refuge. Hobbes joined this circle, even becoming math tutor to the Prince of Wales, the future King Charles II, who was in exile there. But as civil war ravaged his homeland, Hobbes's mind turned ever more to the causes of political breakdown and how to prevent them. Then came news that shook Hobbes to his core. One gray January morning in 1649, word arrived in Paris that King Charles I had been executed in London, beheaded by the victorious parliamentarians. Hobbes read the report with a sinking heart and trembling hands. The unimaginable had happened. Subjects had killed their sovereign. Some say Hobbes remarked that day, "This is the chaos I feared made real." He understood too well the significance of the regicide. If a king anointed by God could be struck down, no head was safe, no authority secure. The world Hobbes knew was truly turned upside down. In the wake of that royal execution, Hobbes set to work with renewed urgency on a book he had long contemplated. He poured into it all his fears and hopes for stability, determined to chart a course out of England's bloody anarchy. He wrote in a white heat, pen racing across pages, late into the night, in his Parisian lodgings. By 1651, the manuscript was complete. Leviathan, or the Matter. Form and Power of a Commonwealth, Ecclesiastical and Civil. Its title page bore an eye-catching image. A giant crowned figure, the Leviathan, composed of thousands of tiny individual people, clutching a sword and a bishop's crook. It was an apt metaphor for Hobbes's daring thesis. In Leviathan, Hobbes makes his bleak assessment of humanity plain. He asks the reader to imagine life without government, a state of nature where each person is free to do as they please. Would it be idyllic, as some dreamers thought? Far from it, Hobbes answers. It would be a nightmare. With his sharp quill, he paints a scenario of distrust and competition where everyone fears everyone else. In such a natural state, Hobbes famously writes, life would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Only the fear of a powerful authority can save humans from their own selfishness and aggression. Thus, to escape this hellish state of nature, people make a social contract, an agreement to surrender their individual rights to an absolute sovereign who will keep the peace. The sovereign, be it a king or an assembly, must wield unquestioned authority like the biblical Leviathan, a sea monster no one can challenge. Hobbes did not shy away from vivid detail in his argument. In one famous passage, he described life without a common power as having no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. In such a condition, he concluded in an oft-quoted phrase, life would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Only by uniting under a strong, undivided government, Hobbes insisted, could humanity escape that grim fate. Hobbes's philosophy was radical. He effectively argued that virtually any government, even an authoritarian one, was better than civil war. Peace and security, in his view, were the ultimate goods that justified obeying even a less than perfect ruler. Behind this reasoning lay Hobbes's personal terror of turmoil, the twin of fear born with him. He believed he had identified the fundamental cause of society's collapse. When there is no common power to awe them, men fall into mutual destruction. The remedy, then, was to concentrate power in one absolute authority. Freedom would have to be curtailed for safety's sake. When Leviathan was published in London in 1651 and soon circulated in Europe, it caused an uproar. It was written not in Latin for scholars, but in direct English, accessible to any literate person. Many were scandalized. Royalists were offended that Hobbes appeared to justify obedience even to the regicidal government. Indeed, Hobbes pragmatically submitted to Oliver Cromwell's republican regime upon returning to England. Republicans, on the other hand, balked at Hobbes's insistence on near-dictatorial sovereignty. Had they not just fought a war to loosen the king's grip? And theologians on all sides were aghast that Hobbes's arguments barely mentioned God's will, grounding government not in divine right or natural law, but in human fear and rational calculation. The more pious were certain Hobbes's mechanistic view of soul and mind smacked of atheism. Hobbes returned to England in 1651, braving the new Commonwealth regime. Surprisingly, he was left largely in peace. Cromwell had bigger concerns than censuring a philosopher. And Hobbes, for his part, pragmatically pledged loyalty to the Commonwealth as the de facto power. But he kept a low profile, spending these years quietly in the countryside, continuing to refine his philosophical and scientific ideas. He delved deeper into mathematics, attempting unsuccessfully to square the circle, and corresponded with French philosophers like René Descartes, though he found Descartes' notion of immaterial mind dubious. By 1660, history took another dizzying turn that played in Hobbes's favor. The monarchy was restored. King Charles II, the prince, Hobbes had tutored in exile, returned triumphant to London's throne. The aging philosopher's loyalty was now rewarded. Charles II not only forgave Hobbes' cooperation with Cromwell's regime, he called old Hobbes to court and granted him a pension. There is a charming scene, oft recounted, Hobbes, well into his 70s, being summoned into the king's chambers to play games. Charles enjoyed debating Hobbes on science and philosophy. Sometimes they played a form of geometrical puzzle together, laughing like old friends. Courtiers whispered scandalized that the king's pet thinker was an atheist, but Charles didn't mind. He reportedly quipped, "Hobbes is a bear, but a tame one." Under royal protection, Hobbes felt secure at last. However, not everyone was so charmed by Hobbes. The Church of England considered Leviathan a deeply dangerous book. In 1666, the House of Commons even investigated it in the context of a bill against atheism and profaneness. Hobbes, terrified that he might be charged with heresy, acted fast. He burned potentially incriminating papers. He also penned a humble public statement that though his philosophy avoided scholastic jargon, he meant no impiety. The investigation eventually fizzled, in part because the king quietly prevented any action against his old tutor. But the scare left Hobbes shaken. Ever the embodiment of fear, he never again published anything on politics. Instead, he spent his final years translating Homer's Odyssey and Iliad into English, works of a world of gods and heroes far removed from the contentious present. And so Hobbes lived on, remarkably long for his era. Friends marveled at his vitality in old age. Into his 80s, his mind remained sharp and curious. He jokingly said the secret to long life was that he made a point to sing every morning. Apparently, he would walk about his chambers, singing aloud to keep his lungs strong. Villagers near his country refuge in Derbyshire would see the skinny old man with bright eyes taking his daily walks, humming a tune and muttering to himself about geometry or the nature of motion. If approached, he was courteous and merry enough, though he suffered no fools. He spent time tutoring the next generation of Cavendish heirs and delighting in conversation with visitors from across Europe who came to pay homage to the author of Leviathan. In December 1679, Thomas Hobbes fell gravely ill, stricken by a paralytic stroke. He was taken to bed in the Cavendish Fairway Manor. At 91 years old, his body had finally begun to fail the fierce spirit inside. As his attending servants saw to his needs, Hobbes jested weakly that he hoped for an easy journey down. "I shall be glad to find a hole to creep out of the world," he murmured. When a friend by his bedside asked if he was ready to meet God, Hobbes supposedly waved a hand and replied, "I am about to take my last voyage, a great leap in the dark." Those who heard the words shivered. Honest to the end, the old philosopher acknowledged the ultimate uncertainty that awaited. On December 4th, 1679, Hobbes died. In his final moments, perhaps fear still kept him company, but it had driven him to the last, to ponder, and to be bold. Thomas Hobbes was laid to rest in St. John's Church in Derbyshire, far from the halls of power that had defined his life's work. England moved on, but Hobbes's influence only grew. In the years after his death, many of Hobbes's once outrageous ideas became mainstream. the notion that government was a human agreement rather than a divine mandate helped inspire later Enlightenment thinkers, even those like John Locke, who opposed Hobbes's conclusions built on the questions Hobbes had raised. To this day, whenever people debate the balance between liberty and security, Hobbes's shadow looms. Hobbes's central message, that civil peace is not a given, but a prize that must be secured by collective submission to authority, remains intensely relevant to our world. In every age, his work poses uncomfortable questions about how much we are willing to concede to live without fear.